and everybody got their back again. Don't take no mess at the Rose Garden. Jesus, they're on fire. They're what we desire. The men in black can handle it. Other teams can scrabble it.
How they win that game today?
There's just one thing you can say.
How does Scotty shoot that three?
Believe me, it ain't easy.
How did Brian jump so sweet?
Believe me, it ain't easy.
It's the flying dive that's in your lap. As Damon takes it to the rack. How the world did they do that?
Believe me, it ain't easy.
Welcome back to the Rose Garden Report podcast. I'm Sean Hyken, the author of the Rose Garden Report newsletter, which you can subscribe to at rosegardenreport.com. Free subscriptions, paid subscriptions, all of that is available. I've got a great episode for you today. Earlier this week, I went on my buddy Seth Partnow's podcast, Call-In Shots, which is on the Call-In app, which is kind of the same type of deal. If you don't know about it, it's kind of the same type of thing as like one of those Spotify Lives or Twitter Spaces or something to that effect. But I went on his show to talk about the Blazers, and I've wanted to get Seth on anyway because I think Seth is, you know, one of the smartest basketball guys I know and a good friend of mine and somebody that I generally like to bounce stuff off of. And so I figured, hey, let's make this a home and home. So we did. I would think that most people who are online basketball fans probably know who Seth is, but if you don't, he's currently a national NBA writer for The Athletic, where he kind of looks at stuff more from an analytical perspective. And for a few years before that, he was the analytics director for the Milwaukee Bucks. And he's got a great book out called The Mid-Range Theory, which is now out in paperback. It's been out for about a year, but it's now out in paperback. And it's kind of a primer about basketball analytics, but it's also just a lot of like demystifying, you know, what people who work in the analytics departments for teams actually do, and draws on a lot of his experiences working for the Bucks and some things in that realm. It's a great book. I was involved in, you know, helping him edit it and stuff before it came out, and then I obviously read it when it did come out. And it's a great book. You should definitely go pick it up. And I thought because of the different kinds of experiences that he's had working in front offices and analyzing a lot of different kinds of statistical trends, I thought he would be somebody whose perspective would be valuable to get on this Blazers start to the season. As we're recording this, they are 5 games into a 6-game road trip where they're now 4-1 on the road trip after beating New Orleans last night without Damian Lillard and Yusuf Nurkic. They're 9-3 on the season. They wrap up the road trip tomorrow in Dallas before coming back for 3 home games with San Antonio, Brooklyn, and Utah coming up before they go out on another little mini road trip kind of through the Midwest and to the East Coast to go to New York. And then they're in Milwaukee and Cleveland before that. So still a pretty tough schedule coming up. Seth and I talk a lot about the defense. He's a little bit lower on the sustainability of what they've been able to do on the defensive end than I think a lot of people here locally are. And he goes into why, and I think a lot of that is interesting and instructive and maybe a little bit of a reality check for people who are listening to this and are just super hyped about the start that the team has had so far and, you know, starting to, you know, maybe get a little bit ahead of themselves as, you know, oh, are these guys a contender now? Or, you know, is this a top four team in the West? Like, I think a lot of what Seth is saying is interesting and it's worth listening to and worth kind of keeping in mind as the season goes forward. You know, so we talk some about the defense. We also talk about the turnover issue and how some of that might stabilize over the course of a season. And, you know, there's maybe some optimism there that the turnover issues that the Blazers have had so far are going to stabilize a little bit and maybe get to where they're not the worst turnover team in the league anymore. And then, you know, we get into Shaedon Sharpe also, and he also tells a story about playing pickup with Randy Moss back when he used to live in Minnesota, back when Randy Moss was on the Vikings. So it's a great conversation. Again, rosegardenreport.com for subscription to the newsletter, free or paid. I would recommend the paid tier, especially with, you know, everything that's going on other social media platforms. It's more important now than ever to be able to kind of spread the word about this kind of stuff because you don't know how long some of these platforms are going to be around. So keep all that in mind. Go sign up if you're not signed up. Podcast, as always, Apple, Spotify, everywhere else you can get podcasts, subscribe, rate, review, any of that. And let's get to this conversation with Seth Part now. Seth, thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks for having me. Returning the favor, we negotiated the Home and Home series, and it would be churlish of me not to show up on from my end.
That's right. Yeah, I for those of you who don't know, I did go on Seth's program Call-In Shots on the Call-In app a few days ago, and I figured at the same time, I think Seth kind of wanted my perspective as somebody who doesn't cover the Blazers every day on the team, and I was thinking, Seth is one of the smartest basketball guys I know and somebody who has both, worked in the media side and worked in a team's front office in the analytics department. So I thought it would be good to get his perspective on the Blazers as well. And so I think that, this worked out well. Though I want to start with this. How do you, as someone who, whether you were back when you were working for the Bucks and you guys were trying to figure out what you guys were doing that was real and what wasn't, or now that you're an analyst for The Athletic and, just kind of trying to write about the league in a way that's smart and thoughtful, how do you decide what, especially defensively, is sustainable and what isn't? Because I'm looking at the Blazers rankings right now. NBA.com has them sixth overall in defensive rating. Cleaning the Glass has them at seventh, which I think they filter out garbage time or something like that, which is why it's a little bit of a discrepancy. But either way, they're a top 10 defense, which, throw out the last year because they were tanking, but the two seasons before that, they were in the bottom five in defense, obviously with different personnel, but I don't think anybody expected that end of the ball to be this good for them. So I'm wondering, how do you look at something like that and decide, okay, this is sustainable, this isn't?
So a rule of thumb is that style kind of stabilizes much more quickly than output. So I think if you the lesson there is look at the shots they're giving up on defense, defensive rebounding, forcing turnovers, free throw rates, those things will kind of coalesce on about what they're going to be by now, unless there's big changes in personnel or trades or coaching change or any of those things. Ball go in or not will be variant all season. Now, ball go in, shot making, essentially opponent shot making is the single biggest component of a team's defensive rating. So saying that that's going to vary a lot means your defense is just going to vary a lot over the season. And hopefully over the season, it 50 games or so, it starts to balance out a little bit. All that saying is you can start to look at sort of the structure of what a defense is doing pretty easily by now. And it'll give you a reasonable kind of directional estimate. And all that is a long-winded way of saying that, it's not everything, but Cleaning the Glass has a stat called location EFG. And it's a very basic, shots in the restricted area are worth X, shots from the corner are worth Y kind of thing. Portland's 29th in defense. Which means they are giving up a lot of shots at the rim, a lot of corner threes. It's not good. Now, those shots aren't going in, but combine that with the fact that I think we would agree that the Blazers don't have elite rim protection, and that is a structure of defense that makes me think that it is not sustainable in the least.
That's interesting because I think most people kind of agreed going into the season that their biggest issue with this roster was the rim protection, because outside of Nurkic, they didn't really have much on that end. Drew Eubanks is fine for I think he plays, he does his job in the 15 or so minutes a game that he's playing, but that's definitely a weakness of theirs. And so for you, it's that they're allowing certain types of shot attempts that are just, not what you want. And you think that at some point those shots are going to start going in and then their defense is going to slip just in that way. Is that kind of what you're getting at here?
Yeah. So now with knowing that there's some kind of slippage between arenas on what's counted as a shot in the restricted area or not, according to Cleaning Glass, they're 27th in allowing shots at the rim and 8th in the percentage allowed. And again, at this point in the season, that first number is more solid than the second. And if that you know, starts to normalize, that gets into the high 60s, you know, which even to being about average, which is 65-ish, that really starts to compromise the defense. And combine that with the fact that opponents just haven't made any mid-rangers against them at all yet. These are things that would worry me, I think. We've seen instances where, for example, I got in a lot of trouble a couple of years ago with Tibbs' first season with the Knicks, where they kind of had a similar profile and they were giving up a bunch of threes and opponents just couldn't make any. And their defense was like really high, like might have even been tops in the league, but it's certainly like top five. And I was saying, hey, if they keep this structure up, it's not going to work out. Now, opponents started making shots, but I think, you know, psychologically, probably the buy-in of having success in the way they were playing, their structure actually improved over the course of the season. So even though their luck, maybe they played sort of better underlying defense, so that as the luck evened out more, it didn't really change their overall output. I'm not sure from a personnel standpoint that's necessarily something that I would really expect from this Blazers roster.
What would you say they're missing in order to be able to kind of change their structure that way? Besides, I mean, the rim protection, obviously, with, you know, Nurkic being their only real rim protector, but like on the perimeter side, like what would you say they're missing there?
I mean, if you have a mediocre rim protection, you're not switchable, and you have small guards who can't really pressure the point of attack, you're starting from, like, maybe can you get to, like, by perfect scheme adherence and stuff like that, can you get to like 20th? Maybe, but the ceiling is pretty low on what a defense can be just from a personnel standpoint, I think.
Well, okay, that's all. I mean, this is interesting stuff. I do remember that Knicks team where, you know, they were just giving up, you know, they were letting teams take so many threes and the teams just like were not making them. And then, you know, the conversation around it became, hey, this is, you know, that Tibbs is just working his defensive magic. And this is like, and I've kind of, this is part of why, you know, as much as, you know, this Blazers start has been so surprising and so, you know, I think fun for a lot of people to watch, I've held off on saying, oh, this is great. You know, these guys are, you know, contenders. They're a top four seed in the West, you know, based on this start, I don't know. I mean, the way you put it, obviously you have dove a lot more into these kinds of, you know, numbers kind of on a deeper level than I have, but this stuff that you're saying about shot selection allowed is pretty fascinating.
And again, the with the public data, that doesn't tell us everything, doesn't tell us the kind of the openness of the threes, doesn't tell us how many of the shots at the rim are heavily contested or not. And, or how much, you know, the mix between, especially on jumpers, off the dribble versus catch and shoot. So there's a little more going on there, but still you see a disconnect between a top 10 defensive rating and a bottom, you know, five shot selection allowed, and also not, you know, an average turnover rate. Like that would be the one big like lever you could push to maybe get away with that a little more. And I don't think, you know, Dame has never been a guy who got a lot of steals. I don't think Anthony Simons really projects that way. Maybe like does a Gary Payton help there? Yeah, but you know, how much does 20 minutes a game balance that out? So I guess I apologize for coming in hot with the negativity, but you asked.
No, this is good. This is what I want. I wanted to have you on because I knew that you would kind of look at it from an outside perspective and actually kind of be able to say objectively like what you think is sustainable and what isn't. So this is actually, you know, I think this is actually good.
So, and here's something to remember, like the wins they have count. Like you've banked the wins. Those are in the, yeah. Those happen. Those don't not count because maybe they got a little fortunate to get there. So, you know, with the start, you take that and then, you know, you hopefully you play a little better and then, okay. Are we 500 the rest of the season when the defense regresses? Okay, well, then we still finish with 44 wins and And, you know, I don't know if you would have taken that at the start of the year, but you might have taken that at the start of the year.
Oh, I think they would have taken that at the start of the year. So first of all, they're over under for the betting lines was between 39 and 40, depending on where you looked at it, at which point during the offseason. And I've always kind of said that that was just, you know, that was kind of a lock to hit the over, whether that be like 41 wins, 42 wins, somewhere in there. I never really had them much higher than that. And Eric and I did a pod before the season started predicting where we thought they would finish. And both of us kind of said, we think they were going to be a playoff team, but they would make the playoffs as a 7 or 8 out of the play-in. And I kind of think now, just because of the amount of wins that they've banked and just the way that their schedule is set up, where they have a pretty tough schedule, right, basically up until Christmas. Obviously, this road trip that they're currently 4-1 on, they had, you know, wins against Phoenix, who they've beaten twice, and Miami and New Orleans. And, you know, on their previous homestand, they beat Phoenix again, but then also they beat Denver. And so, like, they've beaten a lot of this was a schedule that I think a lot of people thought, and what I said at the time was, if they can get to Christmas, even like within range of 500, they're in really good shape, because the second half of their schedule is a whole lot of like Houston and Oklahoma City and San Antonio and a lot of these teams that people think aren't going to be very good. And especially like by then, you know, by like closer to the deadline, even the teams like that that are playing relatively well right now are going to probably force the issue as the Victor stuff becomes real. So I think from a win total standpoint, they're going to hit that over pretty easily. And I think they would probably take that, to your point.
And then it's just a matter of kind of being, you know, honest with yourselves. I mean, I think this is the hardest bit of how being a little fortunate. I mean, you know, lucky is a tough word, because people hear that and think, well, you're saying we're just lucky and we weren't good. No, but kind of we've played well and we're lucky, and you accept that because, you know, that those swings happen over the course of the season. The issue with, you know, you've been a little, you think maybe a little lucky to start the season, is, but you've got the wins, so the feedback loop is not as sort of doesn't discipline you the way it maybe could. Like the shots haven't gone in, so our defensive concepts and structure has been good. I mean, there's probably some things you've done well. They haven't given up a ton of transition on kind of live ball rebounds, maybe a few more on steals, but that's a little bit out of your hands. Like, it's like, okay, well, don't throw the ball to the other team kind of thing. It's like, that's a little bit of a just, you know, stop sucking kind of thing. Whereas, having a top 10 rate of getting back in transition off missed shots, that's good. That's a structural thing that you can build on. But the fact that you are winning, and this is, I wrote about this earlier this week in reference to the Mavericks, and I think that they are, you know, leaning way too much on Luka, and I don't know how much choice they have, but with their roster, but it was working. And then I think you kind of see the flip side of that, you know, the last two games. I think he shot something like 17 of 60 or something in the last two games. And I may be off by a shot or two, but in the last two games, and they lost both, and now they're back down to 6-5. And, you know, it was the number one offense in their league, doesn't look so hot anymore. And so you put yourself in danger of having to have that, you know, having to get hit with the stick before you make the changes that you need to make anyway, because the feedback is not, you're maybe getting rewarded unjustly, so there's no impetus to change, even though if you really broke it down and looked at the shots you're giving up, you're like, ooh, we rode our luck a little bit there. Let's not do that anymore.
Well, I think the one thing that they might have to hang their hats on is, from a defensive standpoint and from a personnel standpoint, is that Gary Payton II has not played at all this year. He's been recovering from that core muscle injury, and I think supposedly he's going to be back at some point this month in November. And I mean, you are pretty high on him, because in the player tiers feature that you do every year at The Athletic, which I promise you I'm not going to be the you know, why do you hate whatever team because you didn't have this many guys in there? Like, which I'm sure you're getting on.
I hate all of your favorite teams equally.
Yeah. I mean, but especially the Knicks because you didn't have RJ Barrett wherever. Like, that's like the big one, right?
I got a lot that from last year's, it was RJ Barrett and Brandon Ingram were the two that I was accused of hating on most.
And what was it this year?
This past year, the year before was RJ Barrett. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah. So there's a consistency there. And there's, I mean, if you look at the player types, I don't love, it's right. Kind of the non-elite wing creator. So,
sure.
I think that, you know, I almost think that Jeremy Grant is kind of illustrating the flip side of that in terms of, okay, he can create some, he can also guard some. Can play multiple roles, can play off the ball. I mean, I think that over the last couple of years, my estimation of Jeremy Grant has sort of improved because, you know, first he was like a high level pure role player in Denver. And then he showed a little bit more kind of, bucket getting, for lack of a better term, in Detroit. And now he's kind of settled into he can do that, but he can also be the role player and kind of that bridge in between. Sort of that, which doesn't make him a star, but it does make him a high end role player. And those are extremely valuable players that, you know, especially at sort of a forward sized thing, are very valuable, you know, pieces in today's NBA. And everyone, you know, at the trade deadline, we need a big wing. And you know, he's more of a forward than a wing, but still, I mean, it's everyone wants one, and starting with one is a good spot for the Blazers to be.
Right. Well, so the whole point of why I was bringing up the tiers thing is because you had four Blazers players in this in these tiers. One of the, you obviously you had Dame in tier two, you had Anthony Simons and Jeremy Grant in tier four, and the fourth player that you had was Gary Payton II, who you had in the fifth tier. So clearly, if he made your tiers at all, that means you're relatively high on him. So like once he comes back, like, are there specific, because, you know, you laid out some of what their defensive weaknesses have been so far. Is there something that he does that you think is going to, you know, help with the specific stuff that you've talked about their defensive weaknesses being, or like in what ways do you think he's going to help?
I mean, he's instantly and massively their best point of attack defender.
Right.
Which, you know, that's, again, starting with guys who maybe get caught up on screens. And a big who maybe against non-water bugs is a little switchable, but isn't a great rim defender and isn't super switchable. Being able to just stay connected to that guy, you know, just it certainly makes it easier for Nurkic. It makes it easier for the rest of the help defenders. And just being able to bother those players. And frankly, like, he also is handsy enough that he probably will goose the turnover rate just a lot. I mean, again, there's only so much you can do in 20 some minutes. But I think he's a player who can you know, force some turnovers, which then has some knock on effects of letting you play in transition more, which is obviously good.
And speaking, you know, so speaking of turnovers, I think the other thing that, if you know, you've illuminated a lot of defensive stuff that, you know, at a higher level than kind of I was ever thinking about this stuff, because obviously you've spent a lot more time working on researching and analyzing this kind of stuff, both with The Athletic and before that with the Bucks, and I have. But on the other end of the ball, you know, we just brought up turnovers. That is, offensively, that's been the thing for this Blazers team right now. I mean, they were 30th until recently. Like, they had a pretty good performance last night against the Pelicans, where they only had 8 turnovers as a team. So they are now up to 29th in turnover rate in the league. From 30th, and a lot of their turnovers just on the eye test were just lazy. They weren't even like, and Chauncey Billups has talked about this before, where like, if you're trying to make the extra pass and you make a good pass and it just gets deflected, then he's fine with those. But a lot of their turnovers are just like really lazy passes that are really obvious, or travels, or guys, somebody gets the ball, they have an open shot, and they spend a little bit too long trying to decide what to do, and then they dribble either into a worse shot where they're being guarded, or they just, you know, run out the shot clock. How early do you think, like, a team's turnover rate or you know, the degree to which they don't take care of the ball, how early in the season to you is that just what it is, or is that something that improves over time with better communication, or is that, like something specifically that there's a way to work on, or how likely would you say it is that they continue to be one of the worst turnover teams in the league offensively?
I think it's likely that they continue to be sort of a bottom half team.
Right.
I think that sort of the lack of this is not a team, certainly the rotations they're playing, that has a great deal of continuity. So I do think that there's some gains to be made there. I don't think, like, Dame hasn't traditionally been a super high turnover player. But again, some of that is you know, the Dame CJ style was a low turnover style, because one of the hidden kind of benefits, it's not worth it, but sort of one of the hidden benefits of kind of a very perimeter dominated your turn, my turn, I'm going to ISO, you're going to ISO system, is players who, like, that tends to be low turnover basketball. So at trying to add in some more continuity, some more, you know, multiplayer actions, that is going to bring more turnovers with it. And so the question is, where does that stabilize as players get more comfortable, as rotations shake out? I think it'll be, I don't think they'll end the season 30th, but I think they will end the season below average.
But what I've been saying the whole time while this happened is, if the defense kind of holds a little bit to where it is, which you seem like you're pretty skeptical of, that their defense is going to stay where it is for the whole season. But if you can just get to 20th from 30th in turnovers, just go from not being the worst in the league to being even slightly below average, like, that, that's the biggest, because right now their offense,
that's no getting from where they are now to even like 20th. That's ballpark worth about two points a game, maybe a little bit more to them. And that's, you know, over the rest of the season, that's about 5 wins worth of difference. Just getting from, you know, getting for, if going from like the worst to just, you know, below average, it would be, does that make up for all of what I would expect in the defensive slippage? Probably not, but it certainly balances it out some.
Cause right now their offense, is 16th, which, you know, for most of the time with Dame's teams, obviously the year they made the conference finals, they had a top 10 defense in 2019. But for the most part, their success has been Dame himself as a top 5 offense, and then the defense isn't very good, but the offense is so good that it kind of covers up for it. So it's kind of interesting that their offense is right around league average right now. They're 16th in offensive rating, and their defense has been kind of what's been carrying them. And I would think that, even, you know, if the defense slips a little bit, let's say it gets to, like, you know, it ends up kind of league average as opposed to top 10. Like, it's like, I think their personnel is enough improved from the last couple of years that I don't think even if their defense slips, I don't think it's going to slip to like bottom 5 where it's been the last few years. It might slip more to like the 15 to 17 range if it slips. But if they cut down on the turnovers, maybe their offense goes from 16th to top 10. And if you have a top 10 offense and a around league average defense, like, you're still in okay shape, I would think.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I was doing some quick, you know, math in my head, and that's about where I would peg them. Just if that, you know, if they go from 30th to 20th in turnovers, they probably end up, you know, all else being equal. It never actually works out that way, but we say it anyway. They end up being about the 10th best offense in the league. And I think, you know, I think that seems, you know, if you're starting with Dame and Simons, and Dame seeming to be back to largely the peak of his powers, that seems about right. You know, maybe do you wish there was maybe a little more shooting around them? Sure. But is Grant a good kind of third wheel? Yeah. So I think that's, you know, the most likely path forward. Is there a 500-ish team the rest of the year, because they've got about the 12th best offense and about the 16th or 18th best defense? And then again, that gets us to the 44 wins we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And so I think one of the big reasons for a lot of the maybe optimism that people around the Blazers have, and the people, you know, the people that I've talked to have, is a lot of the teams that I think people just assumed would be better than them have not been. And so you're talking about, like, I like Denver's looked a lot better recently, but you're talking about, like, the Clippers, who I think a lot of people pick to come out of the West because Kawhi was healthy, which obviously that's not currently the case. Dallas has been up and down. Minnesota has like actually looked bad. I'm not worried about the Warriors at all. They're going to be fine. But out of kind of those teams that people kind of had ahead of them by the conventional wisdom in the West that have been struggling, which of those teams do you think actually have a lot, you know, cause for concern, and which ones do you think, oh, they're going to be fine?
I mean, I think the Clippers just have to be concerned. I think everyone is surprised at you know, how Kawhi's health has responded to playing the first two games he did. I think I really think that the fact that he is, his recovery is what it is, is a worrying concern, because you just don't know. And if he's basically done, which if you play two games, miss eight, you're basically done. I don't know if that's a playoff team. And certainly maybe it's a play-in team, but you think about it, and then that gets us back to the banked wins. They haven't had a horrible start record wise, but they actually would have to catch Portland, and without Kawhi, can they do that? I don't think so. Minnesota, I think Minnesota will end up being okay, but the vibe, 5-7 isn't awful, but the vibes are so bad.
They're not good.
They're so bad.
I mean, they've got, Devin Booker going up, up to their bench and saying, hey, we play team basketball. That's Devin Booker is not a good trash talker. And so when you get kind of clowned by Devin Booker, and it's accurate, that's not good.
Yeah. So would I be shocked at this point if they figured, I think that, you're asking me who I'd rather play in a playoff series between the two. The Dame chip in a chair, but I think that okay, we're looking talent for talent, and I think I would probably rather play Portland, but I think that them finishing ahead of Minnesota in the record, in the standings, is I would say at this point more likely than not. I'm not worried at all about Denver. I think they'll be
Denver's fine.
I think a lot of Denver is sort of Jokic easing him, I think appropriately, kind of easing his way into the season. He hasn't been nearly as aggressive from a I'm going to get buckets standpoint as he has.
But he also spent the whole summer playing in Eurobasket. Yeah. So
it's not like it's not even like a slow start, but his sort of less aggressive start isn't, I'm out of shape. It's I'm letting other people get back involved, and it's a marathon, not a sprint.
And Jamal and Porter have both looked a lot better lately. Like they look kind of rusty the first week of the season, but they've both looked a lot more like themselves lately too. So I know I'm totally with you on Denver. I think they're going to be totally fine.
And I picked Denver to make the finals before the season. And frankly, there's no reason that I see to move off of that. Now that may be as much because the Warriors will be fine, but the Warriors top end, you do wonder about. And the Clippers, worry a lot about. And I guess the team we haven't really mentioned, who the Blazers are ahead of, that I think is going to finish, 8-10 games ahead of them when it's all said and done, is Memphis. I don't think that's who, if you started the season saying, we're going to benchmark ourselves against Memphis. I think that's yes, that's that. If we're in that discussion, that's awesome.
Well, I don't think Portland even came into the season. I have not gotten out of anybody in the organization a hard, we want to be this seed, we want to have this record, but I have not gotten the sense that they view the goal of this season as we want to be top four in the West, we want to be an actual title contender. That's not how they're approaching this season. I think the idea is that they want to get everybody on the same page about playing the style that Chauncey Billups wants to implement, which so far it seems like that's going well. And then they want to kind of use that to then figure out, which of these guys are long-term pieces and which ones aren't. And then maybe we move off of some of these guys, or we just, make some kind of trade. I've written this recently. I would be shocked if there isn't some sort of consolidation trade before the deadline, because there just kind of has to be, because they have so few front court guys and they have so many guards and wings that are kind of redundant. And there's kind of this minutes crunch where like a guy like Nasir Little, who they're very high on, who just signed a contract extension.
I like Nasir Little.
Yeah, and he's been good, but they have so many guys at that position. He only played 7 minutes in the win against Miami, and then he played more last night because Dame was out and Nurkic. Like, they just had more minutes to go around. But it's like, then once Gary Payton comes back in a couple of weeks, there's just so many more guys that you have to put in the rotation. And I guess it's a good problem to have in order to withstand the kind of rash of injuries that they've had on this road trip, but at some point before the deadline, they're going to have to do something to maybe switch out a couple of, and I don't know who that's going to be, but you have to switch out, a couple of these wings and, these kind of interchangeable guard wing type of guys for maybe some more front court depth. That's going to be something they have to do at some point. And so because of that, I think they're thrilled with where they are just record wise, because I don't think they think that the team that they have right now is the team that they want to have by the end of the season.
Remind me, when you came on my show, did I try to trade the Blazers John Collins? So now you got me thinking, like Nas Little plus what gets you John Collins? Because like Nas Little is actually doesn't not make sense for Atlanta. But anyway, but we're not here to trade machine, I guess.
No, I think the guy that I said this on your show, and I've said this other times. I think for them the dream would be for things to go south in Phoenix and the DeAndre Ayton thing to become a possibility again. I think that's what they're kind of holding out hope for. I don't think that's likely just given the start that Phoenix has gotten off to, but I think that's something they would like to happen. You mentioned John Collins. I know that's somebody that they kicked the tires on before the draft when they were looking at trading the 7th pick for some win now stuff. If he becomes available, I would think that would be something they would revisit. The one that I think is probably the most obvious, combination of fits a need on paper and is probably going to be available at the deadline would be Miles Turner, as far as guys that they might be able to actually go get.
And frankly, given what we said about their defense, I mean, if their defensive structure is going to end up allowing a lot of shots at the rim, I think the upgrade from Nurkic to Miles Turner, just in terms of paint defense, would be substantial. More to the point where if you told me, okay, well, they give some shots to the rim, but they at least defend them pretty well, I'd buy that a little bit more as sustainable if you've got Miles Turner back there than if you have Yusuf Nurkic.
What do you think of Shaden Sharpe? Are you a huge draft? Like, how much college do you watch? Like, are you a huge draft guy, or are you?
It doesn't matter how much college I watched in terms of Shaden Sharpe, but
no, I'm saying in general, yeah. Are you a draft guy?
Now that I am no longer professionally responsible for knowing things about the draft, I try to know as little as possible about the draft.
So you didn't have much of an opinion about him before the draft.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I would have had much of an opinion about him either way anyway. I mean, there's just, certainly for the way that I look at my home base for looking at players, he's a guy who you just don't know anything about. You tell me he's an elite athlete and he can play and blah, blah, blah. Okay. I trust your scouting word on that. I have nothing to offer on him either way. There is a risk in terms of someone who hasn't sort of been exposed to that higher level of competition. And I think it's funny because I think they were drafted in the same slot, but the different, it's funny how his reputation has sort of continued unabated. But like Cam Reddish was this like superstar prospect. And then he goes up the next level and he's like, he's fine at Duke. And just being exposed to that next level and kind of passing that test answers a big question. And the fact that he didn't do that that's just a risk factor. That's an unknown that you just right. don't know. Now the fact that as soon as you see him on even a summer league court, it's like, oh, he's the best athlete out here. And there's no question about it. Like that does go some way to answering that question. Obviously, like, is this guy an elite athlete or an NBA elite athlete? Is always an interesting question. And I think if from your scouting eye, I think it's possible you could have said, yes, no, this guy's an elite NBA athlete, because I mean, the alley-oop he caught the other night where he like jumped with 2 feet outside the paint and easily kind of floated to the rim and dunked it with two hands. I mean, that's
he does something like that every game. He had this one against Charlotte the other night where it wasn't a dunk, but like he, you know, had like kind of a pull up from around the foul line and he basically like double clutched while he was in the air and then just like threw up a floater. Like he does stuff like that pretty much every game.
And there's also just a smoothness about him. And I'm going to make a weird comparison, but I think we've talked about this offline, but a pickup basketball game I played in regularly when I lived in around Minneapolis, like Randy Moss would show up sometimes and just like the smoothness of, as a mover is a little bit reminiscent of that. And you know, so not knowing how much your listeners will remember, you know, kind of mid-aughts football, but like Randy Moss is one of the, you know.
So we're talking about Vikings era Randy Moss.
I mean, like, yeah, no, this Randy is, yeah, Moss. Like, yeah, this is young Randy Moss. No, I mean, this is, you know, just a someone whose feet don't feel like they touch the ground when they move. And I think that's, There's certainly a little bit, more than a little bit about that, about Shaedon Sharpe. There's a lot to get excited for. And then the fact that, like, you know, the skill level and, you know, we talked about this on my show, the fact that he's, like, you know, trying on defense. Like, we can work with this.
Well, the other thing that guys talk about with him, you know, whether it be Chauncey or Dame or whoever, is that he picks stuff up really quickly. Apparently, you know, if he doesn't know a set and you explain it to him once or twice, then he's just got it from there and doesn't really make the same mistake twice, which is always something, especially for a guy who hadn't played in so long, you know, at a high competitive level. That's something you want from a young player, is just being willing to, or not just willing, but able to process all of that information and retain it and, you know, be able to adapt quickly.
Right. And that's sort of the not knowing that is the risk factor of a guy not, but it appears like, you know, it appears that the Blazers rolled Yahtzee in terms of like all the unknowns, just kind of, you know, the mystery box could be anything, kind of thing, but all the blank boxes kind of filled with like nines and tens, which is something we have a tendency to do in draft evaluation, getting carried away from ourselves. But obviously, like, on average, people are going to be more average. And with Sharpe, it appears that the evaluation, I think that Mike Schmitz was someone who was just huge on Shaedon Sharpe.
He was
in the evaluation process. And, you know, you gotta give that some credit. Like that's someone who knows what they're talking about, I think, quite clearly. Doesn't mean he's right every time, but I think there's some signal there, certainly.
Well, he's 2 for 2 so far because he hasn't really played that much, but with all these injuries, Jabari Walker has gotten in the game a little bit. And every time he's been out there, he's made at least one or two plays that are just smart basketball plays. Like he'll grab a loose ball. He can knock down an open jumper. Like, he seems like he's one of those guys, and people kind of thought this going back to summer league, but he's somebody that, like, you watch him and you're just like, this guy is going to be a quality, you know, serviceable NBA role player and rotation player for 10 years. And I have to assume that. I mean, I think Chauncey had something to do with drafting him because he's a Colorado guy, and I know Chauncey is still really tapped into that program. But you have to kind of say Mike Schmitz is 2 for 2 so far, if he was kind of the big driver in a lot of their draft evaluations.
I mean, yeah. I mean, talked earlier about luck. I mean, there's like, you can be good, but also for draft picks to work out, you have to be lucky.
And totally.
Nothing wrong with being lucky, but you if you start, instead of making 50-50 bets, making 60-40 bets, you know, over a few years, you're going to tend to get ahead. And you know, I think we don't want to throw parades after one draft, but it's the indications are good so far.
We kind of glossed over the fact that you used to play pickup with Randy Moss in Minnesota. What's your best Randy Moss pickup story?
It's on the internet somewhere. There's a couple good ones. One I can tell publicly that I don't have time to go all the way through. Basically, ended with him getting into an argument with one of my college teammates who was the best player on my college team and like was until recently the all-time leading scorer, who pinned his attempted layup to the backboard with both hands, and Randy tried to call goaltend, and there proceeded to be like about a 5 minutes. It seemed like 20 minutes at the time. It was probably about 5 minutes in real time argument about whether the basket counted or not. And the argument ended by my friend, my former teammate, shouts to Josh, basically winning the argument by saying, "Hey, look, I wouldn't try to cheat you, buddy." and that seemed to shame Randy into play. But no, I played with him. I played both against and with him in pickup games, and he was quite good.
Yeah, that's great. That's probably a good note to wrap up on. Before I let you go, I've obviously read your book, Mid-Range Theory. Some of my listeners probably haven't, so give me the quick, elevator pitch for why, if you're a fan of the NBA and you're interested in getting smarter about the NBA, why you should read your book.
So my attempt with the book was, I don't like the way analytics are talked about. I don't really even like the term analytics. And so I tried to break down some topics from a statistical standpoint in a way to illustrate that we're still just talking about basketball and we're looking at it a slightly different way, but all the concepts we're talking about from a statistical perspective are things that are recognizably basketball. I mean, a baseline of basketball analysis from which we talked about earlier, when we were talking about the defense, is the four factors. It's, effective field goal percentage, rebounding percentage, free throw rate, rebounding percentage. Every coach you've ever had, what did they tell you? Take good shots, take care of the ball, don't foul, protect the backboard. So this is what basketball is. And it's just there's a way of quantifying that and comparing across teams that makes it a little less subjective in terms of who's doing what well. And there's examples of that all throughout the game, and hopefully it helped illustrate like those things in a way to make it less scary, demystify it. You don't have to have a PhD in linear algebra to understand what's going on. And also just, try to tell a few, inside stories and make some jokes at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I'm, having read the book before it came out and then when it came out, obviously as a finished product, I think it does a great job of kind of explaining some of this stuff to people who maybe aren't in it like we are. You and I are kind of in it in different ways. You've worked for a team in their analytics department. I just kind of, when it comes to that kind of stuff, I know enough to be able to know what I'm talking about, but I'm not as deep in the weeds as you are. And I think the book does a really good job of taking those concepts and making it so that the average person can understand it without losing any of the nuances that are important to understand. So the Mid-Range Theory, go get it. It's available wherever you get. It's out in paperback now, right?
Yeah, it came out in paperback on opening night. So, okay. I guess my publisher knows what they're doing in terms of releasing a basketball book on opening night of the season.
Awesome. Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I pitch one more thing before I go?
Of course.
With whatever's going on Twitter, like everyone else, I'm not sure I'm starting a newsletter, but I'll probably be doing something, some kind of content distribution. So I'm starting a mailing list. So in the possibility that somehow Twitter is no longer available to us, you can go to sethpartnow.com and there's a link to hit to get on the mailing list for updates on where you can find probably some more like daily bite-sized or regular bite-sized content for me looking at things from a statistical perspective.
Awesome. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes when I edit this and get it posted. Thanks a lot for doing this, man. I always appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me. Enjoy it.